Hello, listeners, and welcome to the second of our Sportspiel Judo specials. Ahead of the European Championships, we have now heard from Sally Conway on episode 22 and Natalie Powell. On this episode, I got to chat to Commonwealth champion Nakoda Smythe-Davis, who got into the sport because her mum wanted her to learn how to defend herself. In this revealing and honest conversation, Nakoda tells us about her progression in judo, but also what life was like growing up on a London estate. She tells us about how the London 2012 Olympics inspired her, and the rise she has been on to claim Commonwealth gold, become an Olympian, and also win World Championship bronze. So without further ado, we hope you enjoy our one-on-one interview with Nakoda. Welcome everyone to our latest feature interview and completing our hat trick of judo stars. It is a very warm welcome to Commonwealth gold medalist and World Championship bronze medalist Nakoda Smythe-Davis. Thanks for coming onto the show, Nakoda. How are you?
Hi, I'm good, thank you.
All good. So now if you go to British Judo's website and your own personal profile on it, it says you got into the sport at the age of six because your mother wanted you and your brother to be able to defend yourselves. So I suppose my first question is, why was that important to her?
I think my mum, having not grown up in Great Britain, she grew up in Jamaica, you know, straight away, definitely a more tougher lifestyle. And I think she wanted us to be tough as well. And I think growing up in the estates in London weren't the nicest of places at times, so I think it was important for her that we could definitely defend ourselves if we ever needed it on the streets. Yeah. Thankfully, I've never needed it, but yeah.
Exactly. So, growing up in London, then with a mum who isn't from the area, what is that like for you growing up?
I mean, at the time when you're a kid, you're pretty oblivious to things, and you're just getting on with your life, playing with my brother all the time or going to school. But I think hearing stories now, my mum says it was really tough. She didn't have a lot of money, and obviously was looking after two young kids on her own. It was tough. And I remember, especially as I got older, there were times where, you know, we'd struggle to pay for the gas and electricity, to pay for food, to pay for my judo. It definitely wasn't easy. So I knew from a very young age that if I wanted to be successful in life, that I definitely had to work for it, and I had to do well at school, and I had to do well in whatever I was doing to kind of better myself and better my family situation.
So I'm hearing about you talking about your mum there. It strikes me there's a lot of tenacity there on her part. Is that something that you've kind of taken from her, and maybe why you took to judo so well?
Definitely, if you've ever met my mum, you will never forget her. She's a very, very fierce woman. She speaks her mind, and she's confident, and she definitely pushed me a lot as a kid to do well. You know, I just remember hearing stories from her growing up in Jamaica and stuff, and you know, life wasn't easy for her, and she always tried to remind me of that. I've got opportunities, I've got the opportunity to make something of myself, and I shouldn't waste it. So I think I've definitely taken that with me, and whenever I do my sport or anything in life, really, I try and give it everything. And she also helped me to become aggressive, because I was very, very shy, and she kept saying to me, "Coda, you're going to beat these girls, you're going to have to be just as aggressive. You can't be nicey-nice, you've got to be aggressive as well if you want to win."
So I imagine in terms of role models, she's probably right up there as like number one. Are there any other people that were around you at that time that you see as real role models?
My mum, I think looking back now, definitely later on in my teenage, going into my 20s, I definitely just started to understand a lot of the hardships that my mum went through and the sacrifices she made when I was growing up. But sort of going through my younger years and definitely establishing myself within judo, My coach at the time, my coach Joe at the time, was a really big influence on me, and kind of steered me in the right direction on kind of all different turns and, you know, important times of my life. You know, going through GCSEs, going through college and A-levels, you know, at times where things were difficult, I was struggling to juggle things, struggling to find a job when I left college, struggling with money. She's been there throughout the whole time, inspiring me and kind of keeping that dream alive that I can actually go all the way when I'd never really believed in myself and never actually thought, well, I could go to the Olympics. I just didn't ever think that was a possibility for someone like me.
Yeah, exactly.
So she's been a massive, massive influence on the dream and being able to get this far in my career.
Mm-hmm. So you say obviously that there's her influence there, but at what point did you believe that you could go all the way to an Olympics?
And people will say I'm mad when I say this, but I actually didn't believe I was going to qualify to the Olympics until probably about a year before. I was already doing well, just coming onto the senior circuit out of juniors. And I was picking up the odd result, nothing, you know, major, but the odd World Cup medal. And I think for my coaches, the coaches around me at the time, so I'd already moved to the centre by this point, but also my home coach, Joe, was still very involved. Olympics was always in sight, and I could never see that. I just thought, well, I'm just going to keep my head down, keep working hard, and see what happens. And in 2015, I think it was maybe May 2015, I won the Croatia Grand Prix, and that was the first lot of points for the second year of the Olympic cycle. So second year of the Olympic cycle, any points you win stay whole. They don't get halved, which means all the points that you win in the second year are so much more important than any other year. And I won the first tournament of the second year, and that just like catapulted me right into fourth place on the Olympic ranking list. And then I was like, whoa, okay, I'm in a good position right now. I beat some good people today, and I think I'll qualify for the Olympics. And to me, that's when it kind of was real.
Yeah, I mean, that strikes me quite a lot, actually, that it was so late when you actually did believe that you could actually qualify. And interestingly, you also volunteered at the judo at London 2012, I think I'm right in saying.
Yeah.
Is seeing that as well from the sidelines something that kept pushing you and pushing you, even though you didn't believe that it was possible?
100%. I think actually volunteering there made me want to go and train full time. I wasn't training full time at the time. I was actually working, having just left education. I was working and just kind of finding my feet, as you do as a 19-year-old who's just stepped out of college. And I wasn't enrolled to go to university that year. I was taking a gap year. So I think volunteering at the Olympics was the most amazing experience. And actually being around the British judo athletes at the time, Sally and Gemma and some of the females at the time, they were just so inspiring for me, because to me they were just judo players. And then actually seeing them in that environment, competing on that stage and performing as well as some of them did, was just inspiration for me. I was just like, yeah, this is something I want to do. I definitely want to try and go to the next Olympics, but mostly with Tokyo in sight. And yeah, that was the decision I made to definitely go full-time.
And that brings me perfectly onto my next question, because when you turn full-time, how difficult a switch is that, and what do you need to do to be successful at it?
I think, honestly, I was apprehensive about going full-time at the Centre of Excellence. It was just opening up in Warsaw. And I think I had the mindset that I liked my coach at home, and I liked what we were about, and I liked our philosophies, and I was apprehensive about moving to a centre with new coaches, with new people, with a setup that I wasn't used to. I'm very used to a very homely club environment, and we were definitely going to be stepping into something a lot colder than that. And I was very, very apprehensive about going, but for me, it was more important to get that stability. I think leading a life where I was trying to work all the time on top of finding time to train in and around working hours, traveling and getting straight back from traveling and having to work, you know, double shifts and things like that just to kind of make up on all the money I'd lost, it wasn't going to be sustainable for very long. So I think I had to make that decision to go for stability and my own sanity as well. And definitely if I'm going to, you know, chase that dream, as you'd put it, then I have to kind of put all my eggs in one basket and go to the place that I know can offer me what I need.
Exactly. So that environment around you basically needs to be perfect for you to perform at your best.
Yeah, more or less, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So then obviously it clearly worked because you did get to an Olympics. And in 2014 in Glasgow at the Commonwealth Games, you won gold for England. Yeah. How big a moment was that for you?
I think, again, it was massive, and it didn't really hit me at how big it was going to be until, you know, we were going to kitting out and getting all our stuff to get ready to go there. And I sort of realised, well, this is like my first Games experience, because I don't think I'd been to a Games before that. I went to Baku Games after that, and then to Rio, but that was kind of my first Games experience, and actually being in the multi-sport event, it was massive. And so to be able to go on and win on the, I think I was on the one of the first days of the competition, was just massive. All the media we got around there, all the attention we got, and actually how much being Commonwealth champion, you know, weighs in the real world, was just massive. Whereas judo, especially in Great Britain, has never been looked at as a very big sport or all that important. And just all the attention we got around that and being Commonwealth champion was so big that it wasn't really till after I'd won the event that I realised sort of how great that achievement was.
Yeah. I mean, you say you didn't believe about the Olympics, but did you believe you could really put a marker down when the Commonwealth Games arrived?
Definitely. I knew I was within a good chance of being on the podium, but I probably could speak for most judo players. You can never win a medal in your mind. You have to wait until the day. You have to go out there and take it fight by fight, exchange by exchange. You can never just say, oh, I guaranteed a medal this competition. Even though I knew on paper I was looking to beat one of the best players there at the tournament, I knew that with that pressure I had to then go and deliver and do the job. And I think that was the most nerve-wracking thing. I think my semi-final was probably the most nerve-wracking fight I've ever had. I knew I had to get through that fight and get to the final to be within a shot of winning gold.
Yeah. And you mentioned, obviously, a lot of eyes were on you during that competition because it is this big multi-sport event.
Yeah.
Do you try and shut that out while it's going on, or is it something you can open up and embrace?
I think we were definitely encouraged to think about, you know, our social media, how soon into the tournament we were going to still be on social media. We were definitely encouraged just to follow our normal routine, even though a middle of the day weigh-in was really weird for me, weighing in at one in the afternoon, because we usually weigh in the evening. But we just had to try and keep things similar to what I would usually do towards preparation for a normal competition, and focus on the judo. If you always like bring it back to the actual heart of your sport, the judo, what you're actually doing on the mat, then I feel like every competition can feel the same. So even though it wasn't, because there were so many things that were different, you know, the build up, like I said, the weigh in, where we were staying, everything about it was just completely different. I had to try and just focus on, you know, my actual judo.
Yeah, and obviously we're a matter of days since the Gold Coast 2018 Games closed.
Yeah.
Was it disappointing that judo wasn't showcased or on the schedule this time around?
Yeah, I think it's massively disappointing. When I was watching the opening ceremony and seeing all the guys from all the different sports that I knew there, I was definitely a sense of jealousy there. I really wanted to be there as well and be there competing. So yeah, really disappointing for judo, and a shame we have to wait another 4 years to defend our titles, basically.
Yeah, is it something you can't really dwell on just because it's so out of your control?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same for anyone in judo. There's nothing we can do about it, but it is massively, you know, it hit me hard when I saw the opening ceremony. I saw all the people that I know from, but that I'd met at the Olympics and along the way and along our journey, it would have been amazing to be a part of this one as well.
Yeah, exactly. But we know it'll be back in 4 years' time. So
yeah,
competition-wise or competitively, what's been your own personal highlight so far of your career?
I think there's been so many different moments in my journey that have been special to me. But if I speak about more recently, probably winning my world bronze medal, and just kind of a lot of people don't know the backstory to how that medal came about. And it wasn't one that I was used to. I was never used to winning big medals off the back of no competitions. And that's how my build-up to the World Championships in 2017 was.
Yeah. So in terms of the backstory then, for people who don't know, what was it?
After Rio, I took a break. I think a lot of Sally's and people that had been to two Olympics by this point had said to me, Dakota, you're going to want to just crack on again and get back on training and stuff, but have a break. Trust me, have a break. It will be, you know, you'll regret it if you don't. So I said, right, I'm going to have a break. And I went on a few holidays, and then I had surgery booked in for a month and a half later on my wrist. I'd had a problem with it throughout the whole Rio cycle, but it was sort of perfect time to get it sorted. And sort of from hospital bed to back on the mat fighting, there was about 5 months. And I trained for a little bit, and my first tournament back was in the following April, so that was April of 2017, where I was fighting in the Georgia Grand Prix. And in the third fight of the competition, so I think for me this was in the repechage, this was to get into the bronze fight, I felt something weird in one of the exchanges on my hand, and I thought, right, shake it off, just carry on, get to the end of the fight. And I won that fight, and I got into the bronze fight. On the way back from the tunnel into the warm-up area, I turned to the coach that was with me at the time, and I just said, my thumb does not feel right. There's something wrong with it. It started to swell straight away. And so we had the normal sort of 2-3 hour break before the final block. And when I got up to start warming up again for the bronze fight, I couldn't grip up. My thumb was sore. I was in pain. I couldn't grip with it. It was weak. But as you do, you just get on and you try and go and win a medal. I didn't win a medal. I got caught in the first exchange against this girl. I was fighting upper weight categories while I was fighting 63s on my first one back. So even though I'd lost the bronze and I'd got fifth place, I was happy with my performance. But I was obviously knew I was going home with an injury. So we got home, and this was around similar time to now, actually. Oh, it's today. It was a year today, because for the 17th today, that I had surgery on my thumb. So this was, again, just a week before the Europeans. I got the bad news. I had a few opinions, and we couldn't find the tear initially. And then I went to see a specialist in London just before the Europeans, and he told me, like, the worst news. He just said, basically, you've fully ruptured the ligament in your thumb. 99% you're going to need surgery, and, you know, you can make the call on the Europeans. So I didn't fight the Europeans last year. I ended up having surgery again, which was exactly 6 months after my wrist surgery, and exactly a year today. So I basically ended up spending a year in rehab, and on the build-up to the Worlds, we just took it really slowly, and I didn't actually compete before the Worlds. So I started training again back in June, and from June to August, I basically just trained, travelled around. We went to Spain, I went to Germany twice to do training camps, and we just said, look, we're going to go into the Worlds fresh. There's no competitions beforehand. I gave myself a long time to bring down my weight and to make weight properly. And I was just so relaxed on the day that I think that just played in my favour. I had nothing to lose. I'd come off the back of two surgeries. And I just went out there and just fought each fight one at a time. And, yeah, I ended up with bronze at the end of the day. And it was just an insane day, but definitely one of my best days and one of my highlights of my judo career so far.
Yeah, exactly. When you sum up what you went through in the run-up to that, it's clear to see why that is so high up in your career highlights
yeah.
there. Regarding injury, because we've obviously had a few athletes on this podcast before who've been through serious injuries.
Yeah.
What's the key to coming out stronger at the other end? Because it's so easy just to kind of give in during it.
I think it's being okay with having bad days. I think if you try and put on a brave face all the time, every day, to everyone around you, the coaches, the other players, I think that can get tiring, and actually then it will hit you worse. But I think if you can accept the fact that there's going to be bad days, there's going to be days where you don't want to do your rehab, you don't want to come in and do your conditioning and do your weights, that you probably just want to lie on the sofa and do nothing and feel sorry for yourself. You accept that those days will happen, but to let it happen, let it pass and get back on it. I think if you dwell on it for too long, then you fall off the wagon. I think it's important to have those days when you need them, but definitely try and stay focused and know that you're working towards something. And time is a massive healer, even though that sounds like a cliche, and you always come back stronger. And I think you can probably see that from every athlete who's ever had an injury or a surgery. They come back and they get back on it. And actually, sometimes it gives you something to fight for, and you actually come back and you're more successful.
Yeah, exactly. And that's quite interesting, actually, because I think a lot of people always say, you know, focus on the end game, which is what you're saying, but also admitting that it's okay not to be okay when you're going through it.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm.
So looking ahead to the future now, and we're just a few days away from the start of the European Championships in Tel Aviv, how is preparation going for it, and what are you expecting once you get out of there?
Preparation's gone well. I mean, my life's all about stories, so it's not been the smoothest journey. I've actually had a really good year, injury-free year, since the World Championships last year. But I was training out in Japan about 6 weeks back now. And on a session, I hurt my ankle and had to actually fly home early. So in the last 6 weeks, 3-4 of those weeks, I've spent just resting my ankle and doing rehab and spending a bit of time off intense judo. So I've been back doing intense judo for about 2 weeks now, and I'm actually feeling quite fresh. I haven't felt like I've lost anything, and kind of trying to put the ankle to the back of my mind and just focus on my opponents, who I'm going to fight in, and also the pressure of being seeded number one as well. I'm just trying to take that all in this week and just freshen up and sharpen up towards the competition, as I know I haven't lost anything, even though I missed a few weeks of judo.
Exactly, yeah. And you mentioned the seeding there.
Yeah.
What is that like to take on that number one seeding? And do your competitors kind of look at you differently when you arrive with that seeding to your name?
I mean, I think so. I think when I've been in a competition and I know the person who's seeded number one, you definitely expect them to do well. If they go out first round or they go out second round, it's like, wow, so-and-so lost, and it's a big deal. So I think I am definitely taking on that pressure, and it's my first time that I've actually been seeded at a European Championship. The last time I fought European Championships, I got a fifth, I lost for bronze, and that was one of the most devastating days of my judo career. So coming into this European seeded number one with the results that I've picked up over the last 6 to 8 months, I'm in the best position I could possibly be to win a medal. So I'm definitely taking that as a positive. And for Germany, that was my last tournament, the Grand Slam that I won. I was also seeded number one there. And I think I did put pressure on myself to get to the final and actually win the tournament. And I think with Europeans, I need to go in with kind of the same approach. Maybe not as much pressure because, you know, it's the Europeans and everyone's going to come on their best form, but definitely to perform the best that I can be on the day, and I know that will take me to the podium.
Yeah, exactly. And when there's a big competition like this in the pipeline, do you like getting G'd up? Do you allow yourself to get caught up in the atmosphere of it all, or is it about staying as relaxed as possible come competition day?
It's difficult. I think you're allowed to be excited about it. I definitely do the countdown from about, you know, 6 weeks before. It's 5 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. And now we're, you know, almost 1 week to go. But it's just about planning ahead and knowing what you've got coming up from now until then, making sure you're ticking all the boxes, making sure you're doing everything that you could possibly do from now until the day that you step out on the mat. And then, you know, the rest will take care of itself. But I try not to get overly excited. When I get there, I'm sure my nerves will hit me on the day, and I'm sure I'll be ready. But in terms of getting overly excited, no, I just try and stay focused on what I need to do. There's still a job at hand before I get there, so that's what I focus on.
Exactly. And I just kind of want to turn to this idea of sort of women in combat sports. It's something I asked Natalie Powell about, and it's something that's been brought up in some of our past interviews on this podcast as well. And I think, say, boxers, for example, because Stacey Copeland, who was a past guest on this podcast, spoke about how when she first got into boxing, she faced a lot of, you know, stigmas and a lot of abuse coming her way because she was a woman in a sport that was deemed to be for men. And I wonder if that is something you've ever faced, being a woman in a combat sport.
I think probably really in the gentlest form. I mean, not as severe as the person you just mentioned has had it. I think when you tell anyone that doesn't know the sport that you do judo, or they don't know you and you meet them for the first time, you said, oh, I do judo, and they look you up and down and they go, well, you're 5'2". What do you mean that you fight people? Stop lying. And I'm like, no, I'm not lying. I fight people for a living. That's what I do. And they're like, yeah, but you're just a girl. Like, you're just a 5'2" girl. And they kind of judge you straight away on your appearance. So I always find that quite funny, actually, that people don't think that I could be a fighter because I'm a girl and because I'm only 5'2". But then there's also within the sport, I definitely feel like judo has been a male-dominated sport for so long, but that the women are breaking through and have been breaking through for a while now. So maybe in late generations before me, but definitely now, I don't really feel the stigma as much. You know, the women's sport is just a whole new game to me, and I don't focus on the men, and I suppose they don't really focus on us. And with the women in British judo actually leading the results and actually getting the best results at the minute, I think we're in a good position. I think our results speak for themselves. I don't think we have to defend ourselves in any way, or justify ourselves as being good at what we do. So I don't feel like for me it's a massive issue, even though in the past judo has definitely been a male-dominated sport. But I think the women have done well for themselves, we're doing good.
Yeah, and is that something you're seeing change from a societal level as well? Because you look at, say, the This Girl Can campaign and the Women's Sports Trust are trying to do, and it's about championing strength as well as, you know, being good at sport.
Yeah, definitely. I think we're so past the days where, you know, the people or men or other women saw women as just being housewives or being in the kitchen cooking, or, you know, not actually going and chasing their dreams, whether that's boxing, judo, whatever it is, being a businesswoman, going and chasing. We're so far away from that now. And all the campaigns that are out there just promote women to be strong. I think the strong woman is definitely the thing that's in at the minute. I mean, I've always been that. So for me, it's just like everyone jumping on the bandwagon of being strong, and I can kind of blend in with everyone that has muscles now and not be the one that sticks out. But yeah, I definitely think we're in a good place as women, as strong women, women with muscles and do sport. We're in a really good position.
Yeah, and in the position you're in, I suppose, as a sense of you being a role model as well, is that something you really enjoy, is taking on that role and perhaps giving inspiration to others, like other people did to you when you were growing up?
Yeah, being an inspiration to the younger generation for me is actually massive, and it's something that I'm actively doing all the time. No matter what my judo schedule is, I find time to go to all the clubs around the country. I'm heading over to Portsmouth in a few weeks to do a masterclass, and then the week after that I'm heading down to Truro. So for me that's quite a long drive, but if clubs request it and they want me to come along and come and inspire their kids and to show them something, talk about my judo journey, then I feel obliged to do it. I feel like if I can inspire one little girl or one little boy to actually stay in the sport, then they can achieve what I've achieved by just staying in the sport. So many kids quit judo because they feel like it's a dead-end sport, or you're not going to achieve anything, you won't get as far, you're not going to be as rich, because you're not going to be as rich as a football player. But that doesn't mean you can't achieve something great in the sport. So for me, I'm so passionate about inspiring the next generation and being a role model as well, because, you know, it's not every day that your average kid from the estate in London actually, you know, gets to where I've got to. And even for everyone on my estate and all the kids that I grew up with, I'm definitely still a massive inspiration. And they tell me that all the time, you know, like, you push me to do better in the Coda, like, just seeing where you've got to. And for me, that's everything.
And I suppose, what with all the stories around London and estates in London as well, it's all negative by and large. Is it important for you to put that positivity out there when you can?
Definitely. I think we have to be real about what's going on, and the crime at the minute, knife crime, and actually how many estate kids actually come out to be something is very, very low. And we have to be real about that. I like to talk about that stuff because no point hiding away from it. That's where I grew up. That's where I'm from. But if you want to, and you're given an opportunity to step in a different direction, which I was, then, you know, you can definitely make something yourself. And if I can encourage someone to do that, then I've saved a life, in a sense, because that person could go on to be a victim of a knife crime later on in their life. So, you know, you never know. Putting your story out there and inspiring people, what's actually going to come of it.
Yeah. And I consider my line of work, working in news reporting myself, and even this morning as we record this, I wrote a story about a fatal stabbing in East London. So what do those kids growing up need to see to guide them away from that path?
It's difficult. I think
it's a big question.
Yeah. I think it's about seeing something real. Because if I look back to when I was a kid growing up on my estate, I never dreamt big about, you know, even if I did dream big, I mean, I really wanted to be a doctor when I was younger. You get to a point quickly where you realise that you're not affluent enough, your parents don't have the money to be able to send you to the extra tutoring lessons or to send you to do this, or you want to play all these different sports and play all these different instruments, but your parents don't have the money to send you to go and do it. So you quickly realise that actually your options are limited. And I think once a youngster growing up in, you know, some of the harsh parts of London or anywhere in the world, once they get to the point where they realise that their opportunities are limited, I think that's when they turn to a darker side of life and when they turn to crime and gangs and things like that. So I think they need to be able to see earlier on that the things that they want are tangible and are real. Maybe it's meeting role models from a younger age that have been where they've been. I don't know. It's a hard question, but I think if they can believe in something and see something that's tangible from a young age, I think that might stop a lot of young people changing that mind, or where that switch happens, where they just go, right, I'm never going to make anything of myself in life anyway, so I might as well just do this.
Yeah, I mean,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it is the ultimate question, and one we're going to be continuing to ask for months and years to come as well. But it's always interesting to see what people like you who've grown up in that environment actually think, rather than just people kind of looking from the outside in.
Yeah.
So lastly, we'll finish this off by bringing it back to sport and back to judo. For any young girl who might be listening to this interview, why is judo such a great sport, and why would it be such a great sport for them to get into?
First thing I always say is judo is a sport for everyone, all sizes. It doesn't matter whether you're short, tall, thin, thick. It doesn't matter. Anyone can do judo, any weight, any size. And it's great for all-round fitness. You work every single part of your body, including your brain as well. There's a lot of thinking that goes involved with judo. It changed my life. It made me a successful sports person. It's cheap to do, especially from a young age, and you get to train with boys and beat up boys as well. that's bit's also fun.
Oh, that's great. And with that, I suppose we better wrap up this interview, and I just want to say thanks again, Nicola, for firstly coming onto this podcast talking so well about your sport, but also talking so well about other issues as well, because it's something not everyone is comfortable talking about, but I know it's clearly close to your heart, and I think some of that work you're doing is excellent as well, and I wish you the best of luck when the European Championships come around in a few days' time.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
A big thank you to Nakoda for coming on to chat, and we hope everyone enjoyed this episode as well as all of our others. As ever, I will just point you in the direction of our social media pages. We're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, and we're on Twitter. All of our handles are SportSpielPod. If you like what you've heard from us, you can also go to iTunes and leave us a review. It helps people to find us, and you can also email us feedback or whatever is on your mind, any type of comment, email it to us at sportsbuildpod@gmail.com. In terms of normal episodes, myself and Will are taking a little bit of a break, but don't worry, because we will be back with something big. Off the back of our 8 episodes in 8 days for the Winter Olympics, we've decided to put together another batch of special episodes, and they are currently in the pipeline. We're going to keep the details and the topic under wraps for now, but I can reveal that the first of these will be released on May the 14th. So until then, thank you for listening as always, and make sure you tune in for some more Sportsbill.